Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 5th on the West Coast, now November the 6th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome anyone listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network as well. And, boy... What do we talk about tonight? Well, we're going to talk about some science, for one thing. But the bailout fraud is still greasing its wheels for another round of $1 trillion or so to be meted out to the criminals on Wall Street and elsewhere. I'm sure in Washington as well. Now, just days after the election, the Republicans are saying that they're not going to repeal Obamacare. They're just going to fix it. And that has nothing to do with your health care. It has to do with more money laundering, more Ponzi schemes. That's it. When are people going to wake up and talk to their representatives? Seriously, you've got to stay on their rear ends like flies on manure. How else can I say it? You've got to make sure that they do what they claimed they were going to do. If they don't do it, we get rid of them. There are lots of ways that can occur, and I'll be talking about that on upcoming shows. Chemtrails are seen all over the country. That's been a topic this past week, and even our guest tonight tells me off the air prior to the show that he witnessed them in Oklahoma City for the first time, right over Tinker Air Force Base. They must be trying to hide all the money laundering that's going on out of there and has been since World War II. All the munitions snuck out of that base and taken to foreign countries secretly. What we pay for and what they pocket. General Motors is trying to sell $10 billion of new stock so it can shed government control by buying back some of the stock it previously gave the government in return for bailout money. Should that surprise anyone? And now the bow-legged Mac Daddy is in India spending several billion dollars with a flotilla of ships. You could call it an armada. 34 ships surrounding the Mumbai area because they say that the attack at the Mumbai hotel came from a missile at sea. Where were they when that happened? Where were they? And certainly Israel played a role in that event. We should be putting these ships around Israel is what we should be doing. Well, I'm going to stop there with the news because it's the same old thing over and over again. Doesn't matter what day it is, what week, what month. They regurgitate the same news over and over. Of course, none of this gets reported on mainstream. They're too busy with the menial task of telling you about the sex lives of dysfunctional movie actors. So we'll leave that alone for the moment, and we'll move on to tonight's guest, who is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. He is our resident science advisor on Evident Footprints, and he's been with me since the beginning of the show. And I welcome him back again tonight. We're going to continue our discussion on his own work in the area of power production. I welcome back Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don. Good evening, and thank you. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I'm really getting a kick out of seeing all of a sudden now they're talking about illegal aliens and talking about money and torturing people, trying to give up power, more power to the UN, as if that should actually even happen. You know, other than that, I'm doing great. Just watching the insanity.
Well, I understand exactly how you feel. But your advice is well taken. I mean, nobody can stop it but us.
Yeah, and it seems like everybody's waiting for somebody to make the first move, you know?
Well, it's the old Messiah complex, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing wrong with that whole approach is, you know, when a Messiah does come, they always nail him to a tree. So I don't think there's going to be any volunteers.
Well, enough people are going to have to get riled up and really ticked off as to what's going on with their life savings, their pensions, and, you know, healthcare is a joke. So, you know, that's the least of our concerns. If we're smart, we'd stop talking about it completely. Just ignore them, in fact, because it's a pipe dream. But anyway, that's not what we're going to talk about tonight. So I'll get started again, and I don't want to do that.
That's quite all right. I understand. So if I remember correctly, last week, I think where we were at in this scheme of things was we were talking about the experience I had with one of the founding fathers of IBM and how he made a suggestion for me to, you might say, discover a way of producing this Dynaflux effect using solid state. And that if I was successful in doing that, he'd be in a position to fund the work. And if I remember correctly, about the time we left off the air, I had mentioned the fact that it took an additional 6 years and a great amount of frustration dealing with solid-state components that weren't even available yet. Actually, the first one we made was used tubes, to be honest with you. But the parts that we knew we needed to make the job work were not even invented yet. That's how interesting things were back then. And I had assistance from some pretty interesting characters at the time that were really first-class electronics technicians. Anyway, it took about 6 years before we came up with a circuitry that actually did what I wanted it to do. And, of course, by that time, the gentleman who made the offer had passed away. So that's how that goes sometimes. But anyway, the device that we came up with, we called the Switched Energy Resonant Power Supply. And it had the uncanny ability of actually oscillating AC power in the manner described by Tesla. And I showed demonstrations of this to many people. And the interesting thing is, of course, that you have two watt meters, one at the source and one at the load, and they give enormously different readings, 600%, 1,000%, all that kind of stuff. And people just cannot get it through their head that you don't have to create energy to make this happen. And that was, you know, the uphill battle I was immersed in at the time, And believe it or not, a friend of mine, who I had known for many, many years, came up with a very interesting solution. He phoned me one day and said that he had been talking to some friends of his who informed him that there was a crusader on the horizon that was interested in developing new sources of power and all types of new technologies, and he had millions at his disposal to make this all happen. And the guy's name was Dennis Lee. And so, naturally, being the type of individual that wants to make progress regardless of how I do it, I contacted this gentleman, not knowing anything about him at the time. And one thing led to another, and we gave him some demonstrations, and I wound up going to work for the guy for, I don't remember the exact time span, but I would say it was about 18 months. And we didn't really make that much progress during my sojourn with this individual because there was never any money. I mean, he took in millions from every direction, selling all kinds of distributorships and whatnot, but there was never any money for research for whatever reason. And so the thing just limped along. And believe it or not, the way it all ended, and I won't bore you with the details, we were on a flight. I believe we were coming back from Las Vegas. We had gone out there to meet some guy who had some new technology or another that Mr. Lee was interested in. And on the long flight back, we sat next to each other, and I was telling him tidbits of my own history. And I happened to mention the story of Gene Carini and the energized flywheel concept that he was trying to promote in his electric car. And for some reason, which eludes me quite honestly, Dennis was so animated over this concept of this energized flywheel that when we got back to New Jersey, he just tormented me endlessly about details for this thing. And quite honestly, I didn't want to get into it again. I was already off in a completely different direction, and I learned a great deal about, you know, the Tesla slash car slash Carini device, and I knew that it had some severe shortcomings, not that they couldn't be engineered out, but they were just, it was just not in the position to be utilized for anything worthwhile in its last embodiment. But didn't make any difference. Finally, he insisted, and I gave Gene a call. I knew where he was. He was retired down in Florida. And so we went to see Mr. Carini at his residence in Florida. And I was appalled at the condition that Gene was in. I didn't know it, but he had had a heart attack. He was as skinny as a rail, looked very, very hollow and deteriorated. And he was living in a terribly run-down old house that was just laden with fungus. And, I mean, you could smell it. It was so bad. And I just told him flat out, I said, you know, Gene, I'm not going to sit in here and breathe this air while you guys chit-chat about days gone by. And so the interesting thing that happened was that he... Gene suggested, well, I have a whole collection of interviews here that I did with various individuals, particularly Otis Carr. And so I went out on the veranda and was listening to these tapes, and that's when I had that incident that I told you about where Carr actually interjected in his own interview the idea that he may have taken something from Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one good thing that came out of the Florida trip. The other half of the story revolves around the fact that Dennis got Gene all fired up again about building this revised version of the energized flywheel. So he gave him a bunch of money and invited him back to New Jersey. And Gene laid out the whole concept to him as he understood it, which, of course, was incorrect to begin with. And guess who wound up designing the thing? I did. And so here we built this 4-foot model of this preposterous contraption. And it was supposed to be like, you know, 500% efficient or something. And when it was tested, it was more like 14% efficient or some really, really pathetic number like that. And I just was very blunt about it. I said, I told you so. And so the fur flew in a lot of different directions. But a few days later, I was approached by Mr. Lee and asked if I would be interested in arranging the instrumentation on this device in such a way that it would indicate a power gain of at least 200%. And that's when I quit. Because I told him, I said, what I know about has taken me years to understand, and there's no way I'm going to prostitute myself on your behalf for some stinking salary when everything I stand for is at risk. And so that was the last time that I had anything to do with that individual. And, of course, I was put on the blacklist, and everybody was told I was a spy from the CIA and all this other stuff. And when I related the story about what he requested from me, the interesting thing is he told everybody that was just a character test. He wanted to see if I would succumb to the temptation or if I would stand my ground. And so anyway, that was the end of my relationship with him. Just a few months later, I believe it was less than a year, Gene passed away. And by that time, I was already working elsewhere. And that brings us up to the time of 9/11. And what happened at that point was pretty interesting. The company that I was involved with at 9/11 was building parts for turbines. And they were not doing very well financially. And for whatever reason that they never made any sense to me, when the 9/11 incident occurred, they used that as an excuse to lay off a lot of people. And maybe it had something to do with the stock market. Who knows? But anyway, that was the first time in years that I had ever been laid off on a job. And so I was forced under the circumstances, having a family and everything. That was the first time I ever went on unemployment. And I couldn't find a job to save my soul at that time in the state of New Jersey. And, of course, I was already in my late 50s. So, you know, God forbid in America you don't hire anybody with any age or experience because that's just unheard of. So I finally just bit the bullet and I put an ad in the on the internet. This engineer looking for work, and gave a description of my background. And lo and behold, almost miraculously, I got a nibble from a company in Texas Now, I won't mention this company's name. Someday I'll tell you why in private, Don. But anyway, they were manufacturing washing machines, of all things. And they weren't the little wash machines like you have in your home. These were gigantic machines that were used in public laundries and hotels and places like that that handled tons of clothing at a time. And they had a really interesting problem. They wanted to be able to predict when they were going to go into a spin cycle, whether or not the thing was going to be out of balance as a consequence of the random distribution of the clothing, or if it was going to be stable enough that they could get it up to a high spin rate and press out the water without the thing vibrating itself to pieces. And they just couldn't solve the problem. And they had looked at all kinds of things, using computer databases with all kinds of vibratory algorithms and lookup tables and all kinds of stuff, you know, that if the amplitude exceeded such and such a value, that it would shut the machine down and restart the distribution cycle and all this kind of stuff. Well, strangely enough, I walked into that office, and when I was introduced to the problem, and I had an experience that I hadn't had since my days in Michigan, and that was I just knew the answer. And I've had that happen several times in my life, and it's one of those things that when it does happen to you, you don't question it. You just know somehow that it's right. And I knew what the solution was. And so I said to the, but you know, you don't want to look like some kind of a nut, because here they are spending millions of dollars trying to solve this problem. You only just walk in, and if you tell them, yeah, I can fix that, it doesn't usually go over very well. So I said, well, look, I said, the challenge is interesting, and I said, I'd love to take on the job, and if you fellas think that I have the qualifications, I said, I'll definitely do my best to help you out. And so they brought me down there, and I moved to this town in Texas, and lo and behold, they were very displeased with the fact that I wasn't up on all the latest computer office programs like Excel and, I can't even remember some of the other various things that they use in offices, for spreadsheets and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the qualifications seem to be adequate. So anyway, make a long story short, I have ordered all kinds of equipment to make this experimental setup using one of their existing washers. And to be honest with you, what I was basing my entire assumption on was my understanding of negative power. And, you know, when you have a very large drum with a wad of clothing that probably weighs, you know, several tons, and it's completely out of balance, when the motor starts to turn it, as soon as it goes over top dead center, there's going to be a reversal of torque. And so naturally the power is going to reverse. And I hunted all over the place for a motor drive that was equipped with a sensor in the electronic mechanism itself that could detect reverse power configuration. And as soon as I found one, and they did have a few, I got the most sensitive one that was available, and we set that whole thing up using that type of a controller. And, of course, the minute that we set a particular threshold into the program, and the minute that the power went negative, the thing shut down and went back to distributing mode, and then, you know, redistributed the load, and then re-entered the spin cycle. It worked perfectly. So, you know, the way my life goes is kind of interesting. We all got involved in the testing of this thing, and they brought in these big bales of rags to simulate the clothing, and we set the whole thing up, and of course it worked the first time. And they must have tried it at least 50 times that morning, and it always worked, you know, when it was out of balance. So they made this big announcement on the PA system that the problem was solved, and they mentioned my name, and they said everybody was going to go to a nice restaurant on the company for lunch. And so that's what happened. We went out to this big Greek restaurant, had all kinds of interesting Greek food. And then when we got back after the lunch break, the guy summoned me into his office and fired me.
That's all he wanted you to do was solve that problem.
Apparently, yeah, I wasn't too useful after that. So now my situation was even more interesting because there I was, of all places, in this little out-of-the-way town in Texas, with no job and no place to go. And you talk about providential luck. I got a phone call the same day I was emptying my desk from a guy in Dallas that I had met, at least 2 years earlier, through David High, of all people. And you know who David is.
Yes.
And this gentleman was a real, real special guy. I mean, I loved him from day one. He just had the most incredible mind and the most amazing character, and he had been an inventor all his life and a multi-millionaire. And the phone call basically said, what the hell are you doing in Texas? I'm looking all over for you in the state of New Jersey. So he finally tracked me down, and the interesting thing was he said that he had freed up a bunch of money, and he said, it's about time we start a lab of our own. So I was thrilled, and I didn't have too far to go. He was living in Dallas, so I drove down to Dallas, packed up all my stuff, and went down there to work with him. And he put together an amazing budget. He said, we're going to have the best physics lab you could ever imagine. And one of the first things he wanted to work on was a Tesla turbine, and he wanted to see if we could combine it with a Dynaflux alternator and use some of his previous inventions, which had to do with the instantaneous production of superheated steam. And so we laid out a wicked laboratory. I mean, we had everything going, machine shop and all kinds of electronic gear and just access to almost anything that you could ever want. I mean, really, I was drooling over it. And I think it took about 3 months to get set up. And believe it or not, when we were finally ready to go, he had to run out to California to investigate what he thought was an infringement on one of his patents. And he said he would only be gone for a couple of days. And then when he got back, he said, we'll switch into high gear. Well, unfortunately, he had a massive stroke when he was in California. And when he got back, they flew him back instead of treating him out there, which I think was a big mistake. But anyway, they flew him back. And when he got here, he had another stroke that almost killed him. And so he was totally incapacitated, and no sooner did he get into that horrible position that his son, who was a big wheel in the company, decided that it was an excellent time to take over, and the first thing he did was close the research division. And so I was out in the cold again, you might say. And after that, what happened was I went to Las Vegas to try to start a shop with George, and which eventually succeeded, but it didn't succeed while I was there with him. And that was a real unproductive period. Let's put it that way. I didn't enjoy living there. I didn't find any meaningful work, and it was a pretty negative experience, except for two things. One thing that happened was that I used to go to Indian powwows a lot because I'm very fond of Native Americans, and I picked up a paper at one of those powwows, and here in the middle of this newspaper is this amazing article about an Indian medicine man who has a glint for physics. And I was blown away by it. I read the whole thing and gave the guy's name and everything. And, of course, he was in Oklahoma City. And I called the number that was in there and made the gentleman's acquaintance. And he was really very receptive, very cordial. And he said, well, if you're ever out here, he said, come visit me. And, of course, you know who that turned out to be. That turned out to be our friend Randy. So the second thing that happened, which, of course, was my saving grace, was that I got a phone call one day from David High, and he said to me, hey, how would you like to set up a laser facility and do some testing on a new type of laser? And I said, you know, I would gladly do that, especially when I contrasted it with the nonsense I was involved with in Las Vegas. So I moved all the way back to Oklahoma City to help David with that project. And it's funny how life is, because just before I left, I made the acquaintance of a gentleman out there who was kind enough to have lunch with me, and he was telling me about his connections in Japan and how they were dying to get a hold of some new technology. So we exchanged addresses and whatnot, and shortly after I got back to Oklahoma and set up this testing facility for David and started working on the this new laser concept, I got contacted by these people from Japan who wanted me to go over there and interact with a whole bunch of Japanese scientists. So actually, I did do that. I went to Japan, but unfortunately, nothing concrete came of that. Instead, what happened was I wound up working with David for about a year on this laser project. And then ultimately, I was introduced to a gentleman who wound up being the first really meaningful investor that I had. And that pretty much takes us up to where we are now, without me going into great detail on the current project, which of course is not yet covered by patents. But it's been a real colorful series of experiences, I don't mind telling you.
Well, you mentioned Dennis Lee, and I had that's not the first time you mentioned his name to me. I had done a little bit of research a while back, and I recall having read some articles about his fraudulent representations or misrepresentations about free electricity. Now, who's calling it free electricity is the whole point here. But there's a site that's got some rather interesting things to say about Mr. Lee. And I always research the sites as well, and it's obviously connected to Illuminati intelligence, we'll say that, where they're talking about the Federal Trade Commission going after him for promising bogus fuel efficiency in ads. These things aren't bogus. These are attempts to slander anyone to stop them from bringing these devices to the market. And one guy says, I'm going to read a quote, just the very first part of the article says it all. You've said this many times. This is a quote from New Mexicans for Science and Reason. This is an outfit out of New Mexico. Dennis Lee has been promoting impossible free electricity devices for decades. Why impossible? Because they violate the laws of physics and thermodynamics. The same physics that explains, for example, why a dropped apple always falls down, never up, also explains why Lee's devices won't work and can never work. Now, I don't know the exact date that this came out, but they reference September 17th, 2001. So this is flying in the face of some of the information that you brought up about 9/11. We're talking 6 days after 9/11. Somebody brings out an article as to how there was a restraining order obtained, I guess, to keep Mr. Lee from promoting his inventions, whatever they were. Now, if he was financing these things, he was still promoting some ideas, whether they were yours or not, I don't know. But
no, I don't think he ever promoted any of my ideas directly, but he definitely, he was definitely trying to do something with the Carini device, and I already warned him that I had thoroughly analyzed it, and I understood what it was supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
but I knew that in the embodiment that was displayed in the patents, it was totally incapable of performing that function. He didn't care. He just went ahead and did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, there were a couple of good things came out of the Dennis Lee situation, though, I have to be honest with you. One of them was, I mentioned to Dennis that I had been introduced to some financial people in Wall Street a couple of years earlier when I was trying to get funding for my work. And this one individual, who I will just call the Frenchman, he was very interested in what I was promoting, but he had an agenda of his own, and he was very blunt about it. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm looking for an individual that I think has a very important key to this whole energy situation. And he said, we haven't been able to find him. And he said, if you can find him, he said, I would like to set up a situation where his work could be funded, and maybe you could work with him. And then from that, if there's success, would flow enough money to fund your work. And you know me, when it comes to anything with science, I said, sure, I'll be happy to help. And so it turned out that the guy's name was Professor Brown of Brown's Gas fame. And the last that they had been able to trace him, he was in Australia. But obviously he wasn't there because they couldn't find him. So I put the word out on my own grapevine, and believe it or not, I located him right in California. So I went out to see him, and I got along just great with the guy. I didn't have any problem whatsoever. We both spoke the same language, and so I interacted with him on my own for several months. And he taught me an awful lot of stuff about the nature of hydrogen and the true methods of measuring energy in the hydrogen ground state and all these interesting things that he was working on and had been working on for many years. He also told me where he got the information, and this is something that really blew my socks off. You know, everybody who looks into Yul Brown's background, basically, it becomes a dead end somewhere in Bulgaria. And the reason for that is he was a Bulgarian, but he had spent the earlier part of his life, Yul Brown was not his real name. I forget what the heck his name was, but it certainly wasn't Brown. That's not exactly Bulgarian. But he had spent a good deal of his youth in a monastery trying to find the spiritual side of himself. And he told me point blank that what launched him on the whole mission of solving the mysteries of Brown's gas was a manuscript that he found in this monastery's library. It was essentially an excerpt from an alchemical manuscript. And he studied it for the longest time, trying to understand how the things that were displayed in that write-up could be true. And it wasn't until he escaped from behind communist country and he got out of Bulgaria, and I forget where he went after that. I think he said he went to Turkey or someplace. But anyway, he was put in a prison camp there because he couldn't prove who he was. And then finally he got out of there and he went to Australia. And when he was in Australia, he actually got enough backing to build, you know, these first units. And the interesting thing is, of course, they worked. And, you know, I spent 3 years working on Brown's gas stuff. And I can tell you it's an amazing, amazing compound. But the interesting thing that happened to him after that was, and I don't know the exact time sequence on this, but the Chinese heard about his work with hydrogen and with this new Brown's gas, and they invited him to China. And he spent 6 years building and studying his own discoveries in, I think it was the Mongolian Metals Institute. And as a result of that, we probably won't even know what kind of technologies he left over there. But one thing that he did tell me that they perfected while he was still with them was that the Brown's gas concept was used in desalinization plants that were installed on all of China's merchant marine fleet. And they could make fresh water from salt water using Brown's gas with only about one-tenth the energy that it takes for us to do it in the normal, heat and distill cycle that's been used since the beginning of time. So anyway, to make a long story short, I eventually introduced or was instrumental in introducing Professor Brown to Dennis Lee. And I went with him to California, to Encino, where Dennis Lee made him a deal. And I can tell you, it was very interesting how he did this, because Brown was very suspicious of most people, and he checked them out pretty carefully, because he didn't want to get involved with anybody that would be a problem for him or his technology. And before we flew to Encino together, when I introduced Dennis to Professor Brown over the phone, one of the things that he determined was that Professor Brown was in debt, you know, considerable debt, not only because of his patents and his experiments and whatnot, but because of personal, you know, living debt that he had incurred over the years. And the amount was about $20,000. And so when we went out to Encino together, Dennis was carrying this big black bag. And you know, I didn't think anything of it because I figured it was just, you know, his normal way of traveling, and he had papers in it, and he had probably a change of clothes or something. We weren't going to stay but 2 days. So anyway, we get to Professor Brown's place, and he had a really long talk with the professor, and he was trying to get him to sign a contract so that Dennis's company would be able to avail themselves of this technology. And Brown was very hesitant. And so In the middle of the conversation, Dennis opens this black bag and he takes out two cylinders that were, I would guess, maybe 8 inches long and 2.5 inches in diameter or something of that sort, 2.25 inches in diameter. And they were made of plastic. And he stands them vertically on the tabletop between himself and Professor Brown. And he says, Dr. Brown, he said, when I make an offer to somebody, he said, I don't BS. He said, I always put my money where my mouth is. And as he's saying this, he's unscrewing the tops of these two plastic cylinders. And then he inverts them and spills them out on the table. And there's $20,000 in Cougarants. And he just said to Dr. Brown, he said, these are yours as a gesture of goodwill. And then we left. And I was kind of surprised because I had never seen that magnitude of generosity come out of Mr. Lee. And I swear, as God is my witness, by the time we got back to New Jersey, the fax machine was running full time, spitting out this long-winded contract. And eventually, after they got the knots out of it, they both signed it. And then Professor Brown came to New Jersey to work on Brown's Gas as one of Dennis's satellite scientists, if you want to use that term. The other good thing that came out of the Dennis Lee relationship was my meeting of this other gentleman. We'll just call him Victor. And Victor is an expert in thermodynamics, and he had discovered the missing link, you might say, in the normal Carnot cycle, which allowed him to build machinery that operated outside that Carnot cycle. And the interesting thing about it is he came to the same conclusions that Tesla came to, even though he did it in a different way. And, you know, Tesla had always said that, if you design heat engines using the Carnot cycle, you're certainly not going to achieve a performance that exceeds the limitations dictated by that cycle. And so this gentleman, Victor, built a bunch of engines. And they worked in a remarkable way. And there again, there was no money to see these things through to conclusion. And so eventually Victor left Dennis, and everybody with any substance wound up leaving Dennis, even Professor Brown. And I don't really know what happened to him after that, but I heard he went back to Australia, and he eventually died there. But he smoked like a chimney, and so that didn't surprise me very much. I mean, the guy lit one cigarette with the other one, and he continued that process all day long, literally. So he also had a terrible habit of carrying radioisotopes in his hip pocket. So I think between those two features, he wasn't destined to stay around too long anyway.
Well, it sounds like every time you met that precipice of success, something happened to the person, you know, your benefactor or the person that came forth with the financial backing to carry these things out. It almost becomes too coincidental, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've noticed that. I mean, my whole life has been that way. But the thing that's interesting about it is, even though I've never really had enough backing to ever get me, you know, to the point where it was impossible, you know, to stop. The good thing is I always made a quantum leap. And so far that trend seems to be continuing. I just hope that, that the times are changing enough between the days when I started on this journey, which was back in 1967, and now, that I don't expect the political climate to be that different. I don't expect the morality to be any different, but I do expect and have seen evidence to the effect that the need for large volumes of clean electricity is beginning to really rear its head. And even though I suspect that the Illuminati or whoever these creeps are that run the show already have a good deal of technology of their own, which they've usurped from God only knows who over the years, I think that if the right set of circumstances was to prevail, that they are on the verge right now of letting some of this stuff start to seep out. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm. You know, so much of our technology is dependent upon electricity of one sort or another, and yet there are other aspects of power production that have been looked at and again suppressed. One is routinely called lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, or could we call it cold fusion? What is your experience with cold fusion?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I'll answer it, but I have to be honest with you. I'm going to be a little cagey in my delivery because
okay.
I don't want to spill the beans on some things that I'm working on, but I will tell you this. I believe cold fusion is a reality. However, I don't think it works the way everybody is assuming that it works. What I believe, and I have seen quite a lot of evidence to this effect, and by the way, I even brought this up to Dr. Brown with regard to the production of Brown's gas. I think that the wave shape that is utilized in the electrical aspect of these so-called cold fusion reactors is the actual critical element. And the reason I say that is because if you read some of the, you know, Fleischmann and Pons published their first work on this, and then there was a whole bunch of people that jumped on the bandwagon and tried to duplicate the work. And they published white papers on the subject. If you read various versions of this stuff, they all had their own, they all designed their own apparatus, you know. And the interesting thing is that they made the assumption that it didn't make any difference about the electrical part because they were concentrating on the nuclear aspects of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, as a result of having that belief, I think a lot of these people tuned out, unknowingly perhaps, tuned out the very element that would have delivered success. And this is one of the reasons why you had varying reports all over the place. Some people had similar results to the original guys. Others found nothing. And there was all kinds of conflicting reports. And, of course, in the realm of science, if you can't duplicate something, then it's assumed to be an oddity. And it's very hard to get serious interest in a situation like that. But from my perspective, I believe that what was going on there was that they were focused on the wrong aspect of this reaction. And and that's the real reason why you couldn't get consistent results.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how do you explain the government's dogged determination to suppress any information or any study, any exploration of those processes outside of government labs? Let's say, independent study, in other words.
Well, we all know the answer to that. I mean, where's the mystery? I mean, you know, the so-called government is essentially big oil. And the Department of Energy, regardless of what labels may exist on the various office doors down there, is essentially an organization that's designed to ferret out anything worthwhile, which will be usurped and utilized as they see fit. But essentially, it's all paid for by oil. So, I mean, where's the mystery? they're not ready to give up oil at this point. That should be obvious.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I had to evoke that answer from you, so I had to ask the question.
Well, okay, it wasn't difficult, was it?
No, it wasn't. Well, what would you like to see happen, Jim, in regard not just to your work, but let's say similar types of research that's being done independently by people with somewhat of a track record or newcomers who have been interested like you were when you were young?
Well, the thing that's interesting about all this is, there's enough information floating around that you don't have to be a real brain trust to realize that what's in the college books is incomplete. I mean, only an idiot would think that we know it all. And I realize there's a lot of PhDs that have that God complex, but irregardless of their personal neurosis, the real fact of the matter is that there's unbelievable amounts of knowledge yet to be understood and reduced to some expression that can be a benefit to humanity. One of the things that I had talked about years ago with a very dear friend of mine who unfortunately has passed away, and he used to run Equity Corporation for the Rockefellers, which was an umbrella or a holding company that had some 60-odd corporations under its umbrella. And it ranged from mining on one side and shipbuilding, all the way to lumbering and oil and radio and just about anything you can think of was part of this company. And I was fortunate enough to meet this gentleman through friends of mine in New York, and we became really good friends. And over the years, one thing we had talked about was the creation of a merchant bank that would exist for the sole purpose of funding and commercializing new technologies. And I don't think there's anything like that. If there is, it's being misused, because there's an awful lot of talent out there. There's an awful lot of very creative people that have great minds and all kinds of inspirations. And most of them die on the vine because they don't know what to do. They don't know where to go. And unfortunately, most inventors are also very paranoid, which doesn't help. But they're paranoid for a good reason. Their ideas are stolen and plundered. They're murdered. All sorts of things happen to them. And so it's not a lifestyle for the faint of heart. Let's put it that way. And I think all that needs to be changed. These people who run the world are also paranoid. They're worried about losing control. They're worried about, what's going to happen to their oil, what's going to happen to their money and all this kind of stuff. And they don't seem to realize that the universe is an infinitely large and endless sea of inspiration and knowledge and all sorts of benefits that is there for the taking. You talk about free something, free energy, free knowledge, whatever. The Creator has put before us a virtual banquet of information, and it gets back to the same darn stuff we've been talking about for the last two or three years, and that is consciousness. He doesn't come and put it in your lap, and hand you the blueprints and pat you on the back and say, here, go commercialize this wonderful idea. You have to do a little legwork, But the point is, there is nothing, and I literally mean nothing, that man has ever thought of, invented, conceptualized, commercialized, and made money on that has not already been invented by the creator himself. It's just merchandised in the sense that it's usually put in a different type of package or it's put in a different arrangement that suits an immediate commercial purpose or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, nature has done it before any of us have recognized it. And so there we are. We're back to the consciousness that it takes to see what's right in front of you and make use of it. And
go ahead.
And I think that, that's exactly what's needed in the world today. And if we're to the point where, you know, consciousness is truly expanding, I think you're going to see an exponential growth in the development of new ideas. The only thing that seems to be missing is a mechanism to fund them. And that's my take on the whole picture.
Yes. Now, on last week's show, some point, I don't recall exactly when it was during the show, I referenced an explanation of how the United Galactic Federation travels, basically, if you want to say, through space and defying time, in a sense, because their technology is able to track the energy grids, which they describe as specific frequencies, of which they've found millions of. They've deciphered these frequencies and adapted their craft to be able to locate these frequencies and then send the craft, say, 11 light years in 2.5 hours. Now, most physicists would tell you that that's impossible, but that's exactly how they travel. And if that is the case, if those frequencies can be ridden on in one direction or discovered in one direction, certainly they're moving this way too, and they can be transmuted into a usable power source. Could they not?
Well, sure, why not? I mean, actually, Tesla was trying to do that very thing 100 years ago, which is why he was stopped. And you know, I think he was stopped with a vengeance, so to speak, because the poor guy died penniless, and you know, your own research confirms the fact that he was probably bumped off. So, you know, these people are very ruthless. They have a certain way of looking at things, and it's their way or the highway, you know. Nobody else has a prayer. But I think that's going to change. I really do. I think it has to change. The only other thing that's going to happen if it doesn't change is that we're going to wind up propelling ourselves back into the Stone Age, or at least the Middle Ages, the Dark Period. There's definitely that possibility looming.
Yeah, I wonder what Zionism will look like in the Stone Age. You know,
well, it probably existed in the Stone Age. I mean, that concept has been around for a long time, you know. And,
yeah.
It's probably going to linger on in some way, shape, or form. You know, these so-called enlightened individuals are really like a fungus or a cockroach or something. They'll crawl into a little crack somewhere and manage to survive through the eons, and then they'll just blossom out again when the timing is right. But I believe that stuff's been going on for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years. So I think it's going to be with us for a while.
Well, I think, and you just referred to man's ever-expanding consciousness. Unfortunately, I think it's happening to a very small percentage of people as far as the whole planet is concerned. But it's happening to enough to shift the tables, to shift the balance in the proper direction. this insanity just can't go on forever. And in fact, just in the last 2 years, it's demonstrated to itself that it's about to end. It's collapsing. And there are enough people out there who are looking at these things. They may be doing it by the book, or they may be breaking rules here and there to see what happens. And there's nothing wrong with that if it leads to a discovery. But there's a lot of disinformation out there about what works, what doesn't work. And I think if you go back to the simplicity of nature, nature is not really complicated. It's man that makes it complicated. Man's interference with natural processes that don't need us to exist. And to obfuscate that information from the very people, or you know, to prevent the very people who need that information to evolve as scientists and inventors is insanity. It's just insanity. It makes no sense whatsoever. And then you have these people who have these cushy jobs, making few hundred thousand dollars a year plus stock options and fringe benefits, that look the other way. They know that the authorities are lying about the reality of these things that you and I are talking about tonight. And they go way out of their way to try to discredit any discoveries that are made. But you can't do that forever. Their time is short, short-lived, I feel.
Well, I sure hope you're right. I have seen some indications of change, you know, over the years. But the biggest problem is that for some reason, the so-called scientific process is not really the way it's described. I mean, when I was a kid, I rejoiced in the fact, you know, that you advance a theory, you test the theory through experimentation. If it's upheld by the results, it's incorporated into the mass of knowledge. And if it doesn't, it's rejected or it's modified and tried again, you know, depending on what you're trying to achieve. But actually, it doesn't work that way. It's really bizarre. I mean, that idealistic belief propelled me through, certainly through high school, and then, you know, through part of my college years. But then I got into the situation deeply enough, that I started to realize, well, wait a minute, this doesn't really work, because it turns out that there's so much bias. It even goes beyond bias. I will call it prejudice. In scientific circles, it's just unbelievable. And a lot of it flows from the belief that academia is some form of divine manifestation, and all these people with PhDs can never be wrong. And if they say that something's impossible, it has to be. And instead of somebody having the gumption to challenge that type of a judgment, for some reason they just cave in and say, oh, well, yes, that professor, he explained to me why it can't be done, so I'll just go tinker in another direction, you know. And I don't understand that at all. I really don't. Maybe kids from Jersey City just have more chutzpah than anybody else, but I believe in forging my own path, and I've been doing it fairly successfully for a number of years. If everybody had the nerve to do that, I think that you'd see a whole revolution in the sciences. Now, a lot of people don't like the Russians, and that, of course, is politically instilled. You know, there's nothing wrong with the Russian people. I love Russians. I love Ukrainians. I think they're remarkable people. But the reason I bring that up is not to demonstrate my feelings for those nations, but rather to say that it's individuals like that or nations like that that have been quietly working behind the scenes in areas which are totally poo-hooed in the United States. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there are things behind closed doors in those type of countries that would embarrass the living hell out of us if the information was released. Simply because of the fact that, you know, we spend so much time, you might say, programming or slanting the educational system to produce limited results in this country. Look how stupid we are. Not only in our educational system, which is a travesty, but in our pursuits of science. There hasn't been one major discovery that I can think of in any field for years. Why is that?
Well,
you tell me that it's an accident?
I think you have to add that hasn't been suppressed to the end of that statement.
Because if it weren't suppressed, I mean, it could have existed and we just wouldn't hear about it. But it amounts to the same thing because it doesn't enter the conscious stream. But, you know, the point is that the world could be a very different place with a shift in attitude.
Well, the educational system in its formal structure worships these people that hold a piece of paper that says they're smart. Even if they're not, you know, it entitles them to make a certain amount of money. You know, they have financial rewards as long as they stay compartmentalized, like the piece of paper represents. And certainly that's not, you know, 100%. Maybe it's 99.9% of those in the scientific community, you know, to strive to learn science and then teach people an inadequate form of science and to throw them to the sharks and the wolves of the international military industrial complex as the end all of jobs that they could have as scientists or researchers or lab technicians or inventors is rather limited. And everything ultimately is controlled by that entity or those entities. So we're lied to about the nature of science for a reason, and that's to oppress the people, to stifle their consciousness, to dull it or to eliminate it totally, to prevent it from occurring. And it has to end. It should make any scientist or student of science who's listening to this angry that has been allowed to occur. And I'm not a scientist, and I recognize the problem. Because science is supposed to solve problems, isn't it? It's supposed to be the pathway to universal creativity, not ignorance and stupidity, and like you said, bias or prejudice. You know, I mean, I meant...
Well, it's supposed to be those things. I don't know, you know, what it has become. But the strangest part is that the people that are immersed in it don't see they don't see what's happening to them. You know, it's like the old story, does a fish know that he's in water? You know, once you get into that whole way of life, it's set up in such a way that it's greed driven, just like industry is. You know, the whole thing about it is you never solve a particular problem. You just always are a little bit closer. That way you get more grant money the next time around. That type of thing, you know, where the ball keeps bouncing. The same thing with the medical research. You going to tell me that there's no cure for cancer? My God, there's been hundreds of them. But they don't want cures. you know, that what they want is to perpetuate the sale of drugs, medicines, and radiation treatments, and God knows what else. And if they really came out with a cure, they wouldn't be able to play that game either. So it's the same bloody philosophy that's being used in every facet of human endeavor. And it's all to the benefit of a few, not to the many.
Yes, I agree. Well said. Well, Jim, we're out of time. I don't know what we'll talk about next week, but I'm sure we'll come up with an interesting topic. And I want to thank you for your input and sharing all these things that you shared. I know I can tell the listening audience that there's a lot more behind the roadblocks that were cast in front of you throughout your career, merely because you didn't want to play the game that they like to play. And I know at some point you will be successful. I know that. As you well know.
Well, I gave my life to it, so, I mean, a quitter I am not, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, we have to quit right now until next Friday.
Very good.
Well, thanks
that
a
was
lot.
That was a good interjection.
You have yourself a wonderful evening and a great weekend, and I'll be talking to you next week, if not sooner. But you'll be on the show next Friday for our listening audience. So thank you,
Jim. Glad to be here, Don. Thank you.
All right, folks. That wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and tonight's guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray. I want to thank Windtalkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints over at BBSRadio.com. Seth Hendrick on the sound tonight. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. Atru Ott. In the meantime, I wish you a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.